You're listening to a podcast from 702.
Hanging out with Clement
on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
And this morning I'm hanging out with Victase Kese, who is the CEO of SNG Grant Thornton. And we're going to get to know him. We're going to not only get to know him, but get his thoughts on some of the key issues. I'm interested in the state of our accounting profession, you know, the state of our country, our economy, corruption, and. And if you want to engage with him, or if you've got a question for him, you're welcome to give us a call on 011-883-0702, the WhatsApp line 072-702-1702. Mr. Sekese, thank you for making time to come into the studio. Good morning.
Good morning to you, Clement. Thank you for having me. It's an honor and a privilege to be here.
Do they call you Bra Victor? What do you put? I mean, it's our moms. So,
yeah, no. So far, I think it depends where you are.
Yeah.
Generally,
definitely not in the office.
not in the office. Yeah, but generally, yes, it's Bra Victor. But the filling station, I'm uncle. So I assume different personalities depending on where I am. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I said before we went on air, where are you from? I know you're from Mums, but where are you from? You know?
Yeah. You know, it's an interesting question because I really didn't expect that question from you, because that question is normally asked by elderly people and they're never happy with the answer that I gave. Because I say from Mamelodi, and they stare at you to say, no, Mamelodi is not home.
Yeah.
But my dad's family were nomads. So they actually lived in various places within the old Transvaal area.
Mm.
So even when I ask my dad that question, he can't answer that question himself.
Mm.
I mean, at some stage he was in Mamelodi. Mm. They left. They went to to the northwest. They left. They went to Denelton. So they've been everywhere.
Oh, Denelton.
Yeah. So,
I was born in Denelton.
Oh yeah. So we still have family in Denelton, but his dad was a pastor, and they would allocate him, on a term based a certain area to go and pastor in this space for 3 years, four years, etc.
Okay.
Towards his late stage, he located at Putadichaba.
Okay.
So, am I allowed to say I'm from Putadichaba?
I think let's stick with Mamelodi for now.
Yeah, sure.
There's been a lot of moving around.
Yeah, sure.
How was it growing up in Mums?
It was a great experience.
Yeah.
A very good experience in terms of my initial formation.
Yeah.
Of course, I was affected by the environment, because it was during the apartheid days, you know, where you could see the effects of apartheid on a daily basis, live with it, experience it, etc. But that contributed to my formation. As it is, I think it built me to who I am now.
Yeah. We're going to start with one of your favorite songs. And then when we come back, we'll talk about your love for chartered accounting. How did you get into it? We'll talk about your journey at SNG as CEO and many other issues. But for now, let's listen to Bra Victor's favorite song. So, Bra Victor, I think it's clear you're not the only one who loves this song. Abel doesn't want to come out of that song. He's just enjoying it.
Yeah.
The OJs, is there a reason why this song is significant to you?
Look, I mean, it's a classic.
Yeah.
It's an evergreen. It's a classic. But I think in this dispensation that we find ourselves as a country, and we find ourselves also as global citizens, I think we really need the divine intervention in our affairs to normalize the situation in so many ways. And this has been a lot of headwinds, and a lot of people have lost hope, but there's still hope, and we should not be hopeless. So if it needs divine intervention, let it be.
Mm.
So it speaks to our situation now. In fact, I had to reflect a little bit when I was asked what are my four favorite songs.
Mm.
And this one came to mind as well. It's so relevant.
That's yeah. wonderful. Mm. Talk to us about your love for this profession of chartered accounting, and how did you get into it? And was there any influence from specific people, maybe the parents, or is this something you just found yourself?
Yeah, look, I mean, I must confess that I didn't initially think that this is a career that I would pursue. I must say that this one brother who influenced sort of choice of degree. I grew up under the tutelage of Butiki Solwane, who I would say was my role model as such, and he had studied a Bachelor of Commerce and was working for Unilever. At some stage I had the privilege of staying with him when he was doing his training at Unilever, and all what I wanted to be like Butiki, you know, to do a BCom and go and work in corporate without specific focus on accounting per se. And I was fortunate enough to be given a bursary to study at Wits. Mm. And
where did the bursary come from?
From Tongaat Hewlett's.
Oh.
Yeah. So they gave me the bursary scholarship. I don't know, because I had to work it back after my studies.
Mm-hmm.
So my idea was that, okay, I'm here to do a junior degree. When I finish a junior degree, I'll be like Butiki and go work for Tongaat Hewlett's in general management or et cetera. Then I realized that I did well in accounting, and therefore I started investigating accounting, and I learned about chartered accountancy, and for you to follow that, you have to do two degrees, a junior degree, which was a BCom, and a postgraduate at Wits. They used to call it BAC, Bachelor of Accounting. Then when I finished a BCom, then I ask my sponsors, can you please sponsor, because I want to be a chartered accountant now, because I've realized my gifting in accounting.
Yeah.
And they generously agreed. And they sponsored for an additional year of postgrad, and I never looked back.
Yeah. When did you meet Sizwe Ntsaluba?
In Tsaluba, there's various personalities in our firm. In fact, the history of our firm is so rich, and now it's not enough to actually, deal with it or do justice to it. So, as a student, I was active as an Abasa student in the Abasa student chapter.
Yeah,
pursuing the ideals of Abasa of changing the racial profile of the profession, of the accounting profession. So I started working effectively on various programs, and that's where then I met Sango Ntsaluba, and I also met Sizwe Ntsaluba, who eventually became the president of Abasa. So we worked with them on various programs, and I was on education committee with Sango, who chaired that committee.
Mm.
And obviously then that relationship at that stage, I didn't know that it would grow into a business relationship.
Yeah. And look at it now, right?
Yes.
I want you to just help us understand. 2 months ago, I finished reading the Nonkululeko Gobodo's book. And one of the things that fascinated me was how she explained the merger between the two companies and how complex it was, you know, because, I mean, the technical aspects are quite easy, right? You know, that's the easy thing to do. The most difficult part is to change the mindsets of the employees and just merge the two company cultures and have one uniformity. How difficult was it to merge the two companies for us to have what really became the first big black accounting and auditing firm in SNG?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think Nonkululeko did very well because she had left the profession for a long time. And I think when she came back to become the CEO of Koboto, you know, she took the discussions that we've been having with Koboto, because we've been having on and off type of discussions, coffee discussions and et cetera, you know, but not on a serious note. Then I would say that she came and we took the discussions from the coffee shop into the boardroom through her influence.
Yeah.
Now, on the face of it, I think the numbers spoke for themselves. So that's an easy part, as you said, because you know the synergies, etc. Then you build capacity, you build scale, and you are able to do more larger, complex assignments. Then deal flow should naturally flow from that. But I think what we underestimated at that stage is the human aspect, the cultural aspect. I think we took that for granted, you know, that because we share the same ideals, we share the same dreams. So this thing should work automatically. And yes, of course, we look alike and we share the same background.
Yeah.
So there should naturally be cultural fit. But that was not going to be the case because there are nuances that come into how you approach business, how you look at things and the time frame you look at. You know, we've got entrepreneurial, long-term view, etc. And we started then, dealing with those matters. But fortunate enough, I think we realized at that stage that we needed, you know, professional help, and we engaged with consultants that help us in that journey. And we were able to build one a common culture pretty quickly enough.
Yeah. And how difficult was it to penetrate the market once you've merged the two companies? Now you've got SNG. It's now competing with the big four firms. Because at the time, there were detractors that were saying, well, SNG is mainly lending these big government contracts because of these black credentials.
Yeah, interesting enough, Clement, you know, there are many factors that actually led to us doing the transaction. Interesting enough, you know, we each were experiencing decline in business. And guess what was the reason for that? It was BBB. And we are black firms in our own right. But we're losing business as a black firm because of BEE. Does it make sense,
how?
Clement? So we were facing existential challenges and existential risks, and we needed to do something about that. And you say how? Let me spend a minute to explain how. So the BBBE framework for service companies like ours, professional services companies like ours, is pretty easy to achieve. You know, you get these large firms that become level one. So we say we level one BE firm. And the narrative at that stage to say, look, Mr. Client or Mrs. Client, please appoint us because we are level one BEE. And by the way, you don't need Sizwenza Luba. You don't need Koboto because we're fine.
Yeah. So
we are black.
Yeah.
You know, can't you see? The certificate says we are level one.
Mm.
And by the way, the CEO is black and the chairman is black. So you don't need that. And we started seeing clients buying into that narrative. And we were actually losing assignments. Before that, the practice, the normative practice, especially in public sector, was that of pairing. They'll pair an established firm with a black firm. Now, when that narrative started, the pairing stopped, and the natural space for black firms, we lost that, or we were losing that. So the options was at the individual firm level, you know what, let's be swallowed up by the existing established big firms. And we forget about this. Or let's bulk up capacity and go reclaim our space. So we decided on the latter. So we came together and we built capacity, because then when we engaged with stakeholders was that, yes, you know, we hear what you're saying, but you don't have the capacity to undertake a contract of this size, of this nature. So it was inspired by then that desire to really strengthen our capacity to be able to do that. And we could demonstrate that. And we were very clear at the beginning that we don't want to be tokens, and we want real opportunities where we can prove that we can add value. And we were purpose driven to do that. And fortunately for us, I think especially in the public sector, you know, that materialized, and we're able to be appointed in very large, very complex assignments.
And is the market open enough though? Because the challenges you're talking about at the time, when there were these small black auditing or accounting firms that used to be, you know, merged with the big ones, right, to do a specific contract, isn't that what the small firms today are facing? Or is the market open enough? Or is there still a focus on the big five or the big four, and those small ones are only given the little opportunities to come in and work with the big firms? How's the market?
Yeah, look, I think our industry, our profession, mirrors the structure of corporate South Africa. If you can see, corporate South Africa is dominated by oligopolies. What do you say? Oligopoly. So a few large firms dominate many industries. So the accounting industry is not the same. And that's not only, you know, the South African phenomenon. It's a global phenomenon. You find that the so-called big four are behemoths. They have a particular hegemony that they dominate. And to some extent, and I think we do say that there has to be a deliberate attempt to decentralize the industry. And again, not only in the accounting profession, but generally to encourage more players to come in. Obviously, it's a process, and our formation of SNG was particularly to be an answer to that. And we subsequently realized that we needed to strengthen our global capability, and that's where we joined the Grant Thornton network and rebranded as SNG Grant Thornton to be able to respond on a global basis and on a global scale to serve clients, because our clients have become global, or as a minimum, they are continental. And if you are not able to respond at the continental level or at the global level, then you start becoming irrelevant. And I think that's the challenges that is being faced with small firms generally, to say they don't have then the scale to be able to do that. Now, they have many choices that they can take. One is to be niche, to say we'll serve this particular market segment and not be big. And another option is to forever then partner with the big firms, because, you know, the framework, the BE framework, does make allowance for supplier development and etc. So what you find that even ourselves, we do it in a lot of large assignments, then we'll partner with another smaller firm, you know, to really do skills transfer and to open up opportunities. And depending then on the scale of such opportunities that they get, then they can make strategic decisions to say, do they want to scale up and et cetera. But in our environment, I think if you want to be really serious, scale is necessary. You have to be deliberate and take that decision to scale up and follow it through.
On that note, at 10:31, let's get the latest in Eye Watching News headlines. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation.
Hanging out with Clement on 702. Let's walk the talk.
It's 23 minutes before 11 o'clock on our Hanging Out feature this morning. The CEO of SNG, Grant Thornton. We've been talking a lot about the merger that really resulted in SNG before, of course, it became what is now known as SNG Grant Thornton. And we've spoken about Mr. Victor's entry into this profession. I've got a few questions coming from our listeners, Bra Victor. And there's a question that Don Kulileko Koboto was very uncomfortable with. And I remember when we launched her book, I said, you've got to expect it because, you know, people have loved to know the background stories around this. And someone here is asking about the lessons as CEO that you have taken from how SNG at the time handled the Vusi Pikoli matter. What lessons do you take away from that?
Yeah, look, I mean, we learn every day. We learn on a daily basis. And I think it's part of growing up, it's part of leadership initially. And I think, you know, there are many things at an engagement level. When you engage people, I don't think we spend enough time to really understand and make sure that there is a common understanding and a common vision, that will lead us to where we need to. So lesson number one is do that. I think that investment, upfront investment in time, we've even extended it to bring psychometrics when we engaged at senior levels, from manager upwards, just to make sure that the synergies on many aspects, the synergies in terms of the vision, what we want to achieve, but there's also synergies in terms of the cultural fit, how we fit each other, and etc., and not ignore the psychometric results.
Yeah.
But two, we don't operate in a vacuum. So you really need to understand the dynamics within which you operate and process them adequately and understand the effect and the results of the decisions that you are making holistically. We tend to generally to be excited about new colleagues coming in, and we forget to thoroughly deal with surrounding issues, surrounding matters, and etc., and the environment in which then you're making that decisions. I mean, there's a lot of case studies that one can share with to bring those lessons there. So broadly, there are those lessons that be thorough in your decision making, whilst not adding a lot of bureaucracy and etc. and stalling the processes.
Yeah. And in future, just to follow up on that, how do you avoid the pressure that often comes from institutions you do government with? You, because at the time, I mean, it was an open secret that there were people that were putting pressure to say, "Hey, Vusi Pikoli." I think at the time there was a tender sitting on the desk for Transnet, and the unhappiness from the ANC was, well, you guys have hired this guy. In future, how do you avoid having an organization you work with, whether public or private, putting pressure on you because you as a company are doing, there's a financial transaction with that institution?
Yeah, look, what we do generally, of course, we've got different services within the firm. The audit being one of those services, it's public interest. What we do is public interest, and whilst we work for and on behalf of the public, that should come first. Anything else should not be primary; it should be secondary to that. What is in the best interest of the public, and that should drive us above commercial interests. And that's a principle that we uphold all the time and every time. And if it needs us working away from commercial interests or commercial opportunities, we do that.
I want to ask you about the state of the auditing profession and just the accounting profession. We recently had a chat on the show about how the accounting fraud was carried out at Steinhoff. And one of the questions I was asking is how Marcus Joster managed to just scam even the most respected business people. I had Christo Visser on the show and I asked him, I mean, even you as the billionaire, because you expect them to, oh, they know better, you know, attention to detail. But for some reason, he was able to do that. And not only to Christo Visser and other investors, but to the auditing firms who didn't pick this up early enough. And that's why now all these corporate failures that we've experienced have called into question the role and effectiveness of auditors, hence the scrutiny of the auditing profession by shareholders and the general public. What do you think, just generally, on the state of the auditing profession? What do you think needs to be done better so that we somehow broaden issues around regulation? I think you're the perfect person to respond to this because when did you complete your master's? Your master's dissertation on audit regulation?
Yeah, I completed it during COVID, hey?
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it was 2020.
Yeah.
2020.
So how do we broaden that, that accountability framework?
Yeah, look, I mean, I would like to say I think there's various stakeholders in the ecosystem. And for some reason, I think generally we focus only on the auditors. I'm not complaining about that, but I understand why, you know, there's that expectations that auditors must be a catch-all in an event of anything that were to go wrong. I think, yes, there is room for regulation, to strengthen regulation, to bring regulation in. But regulation alone, I'm afraid, is not sufficient. It's not enough. We have to deal with the, how can I say, the moral fiber that exists in society. And I think we have, as a society, drifted away from noble values. And noble values that, you know, look at community interests as opposed to self-interest.
Yeah.
And I think it's this self-interest that is driving a lot of what we do, and aligned with that, this whole consumerism that is crept in, wanting to accumulate as much as possible in the shortest possible time. I think to the extent that that is not addressed, I'm afraid that regulation over regulation is not the answer. Yes, there's still scope for that regulation. But one, but secondly, what I did say in my thesis is that you know, we need to look into bringing other stakeholders into the regulatory framework. And I said there that, for instance, for you to be a director of a company or director of a listed entity, there are no prerequisites. I can come out, I'm Victor Sekese, I'm a friend of the chairman, so I'm a director. And I put a proposition there that we know we need to create a framework that you need to meet certain criteria, professional criteria, for one to be a director of a public interest entity, especially listed entity. But over and above that, we need to put in a framework that will make you accountable for that. So in other words, in the event that things do not go right, yes, the auditors must come and account, you know, but the directors must also come and account. Yes, they do come and account, but the level of them coming in is disproportionate.
True.
Because the directors are there more than the auditors. The auditors come once a year or at least twice a year, and et cetera. And they are expected to find all these things that are you know, are hidden.
But wait until the company does well. The directors are quick to take credit. And when the proverbial ish hits the fan, and then they're like, oh no, but I'm not involved in the day-to-day runnings of the company, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and perhaps that's what we need. And I'm glad because there's also precedence that's been set here. Dudu Mieni, for instance, has been declared a delinquent director by the High Court because of what happened at SAA. And hopefully that lets directors know that you cannot just escape accountability. We're going to take a quick ad break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation. I see some of your questions, your inputs. I'll put them to Bravikta when we come back. It's 13 minutes before 11.
Hanging out with Clement on 702. Let's walk the talk.
10 minutes before 11 o'clock, before the break, we were talking about the state of the accounting profession. And Steinhoff is just one of them. There's Tongaat. Remember VBS. Remember SAA. There were irregularities even during the state capture project where it appears auditors just looked away. And Bravikta was explaining to us what he think may be part of the solution here. I want to quickly ask you about chartered accountants. Do we have a shortage of them? I mean, 47,000 probably now with the size of our economy. And what do you think where the problem lies?
Yeah, look, I think there's scope for more chartered accountants. Mm. And, you know, collectively, as a profession, we are working very hard to increase that. I think the numbers are even more scarier if mm-hmm. you look at registered auditors. Registered auditors, we are circa 4,000, you know, to audit corporate South Africa, to audit Steinhoff, to audit Tongaat, Hewletts, and etc. That number is barely enough. So, but we've got a lot of challenges, and a lot of challenges are structural in their nature, and starts from the schooling system. Mm. Because in the schooling system, you know, for one to study accounting post as high school, you need to have done mathematics, and we find that in the schooling system, there is a tendency, even the educators, to encourage their students not to do mathematics but to do maths literacy, and that eliminates quite a number of potential accountants from doing that. Now, the few that are remaining, we compete with other professions for that few. You know, there's actuaries, there are entire shortage of actuaries, there's medicine, there's engineering, and then you've got accounting. So, until one then adequately deals with those structural issues, we still have challenges. But, you know, COVID also, with this globalization and work from anywhere process, we've seen a lot of migration, physical and virtual, where a lot of accountants, CAs, are not actually working for the South African economy. Some of them are actually sitting here in Joburg, but doing assignments for other countries that are there. So that exacerbates the challenge that we have of skill shortage.
Yeah, sure. The sooner we really get that work at ground level, the better. Yeah. How do you feel about where the country is right now? There's a lot of uncertainty around where we're going. We've got a president who may or may not be impeached, or at least go through that impeachment process. If there's one thing about the markets, is they don't want uncertainty, especially political uncertainty. So it can be difficult to be optimistic when you are in the face of brazen crime that we often witness: load shedding, sluggish economy, spiraling unemployment, you know, high inflation, gender-based violence, and the political challenges we face now. Are you concerned at all about the future of the country?
Yeah, Clement, I mean, it does concern one. Obviously, what we're going through, it's unfortunate and it's challenging in many ways. However, I still believe that and will come out stronger. I mean, if you look at the electricity challenges, and I was thinking about it the other day, we've moved and you were asking about lessons, here's a lesson. We moved from a situation where we had excess power.
Mm.
I mean, at some stage, Eskom was paying municipalities not to produce electricity. They would come to Joburg to say, please shut down your power stations and here's money. We'll give you money for that because we had so much excess electricity and would export our electricity. Now, to come to a situation where we've got such a critical shortage, it's really, unbelievable. But I think in due time, we will come out of all this stronger. I think we have the basics in terms of resources that are there. Yes, we really need to pull together collectively as a civil society, various stakeholders to try and resolve the issues, because at least we've got potential. That's what comforts me. We've got great potential. And formation of SNG was also inspired by the potential that we had as professionals, but also the potentials that we have in South Africa, but not only in South Africa, but in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And we believed in that potential, and we believe that we can play our own unique role. Yes, in a small way, in a small space, but in within our area of influence, to make a better life for all a reality.
Mm.
And I think instead of us, giving up, we need to look at ourselves. What can I do as an individual, as a member of SNG, as a member of SAICA, as a member of ABASA, as a member of civil society, and do something about it? And I believe if we all do that, we will overcome.
Yeah. What have you learned as a business leader over, and how long have you been CEO now? Sure.
No, you must not do that. I didn't become a CEO by design. I don't know. A lot of people don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
When Sizwe left in 1998, I think we are all, he was our CEO at that stage, and we were all busy doing our little things and etc. And he called a meeting. I think it was a Friday or a weekend. I can't remember, either a Friday or weekend, and to deliver this news that he's gotten offer never to be refused.
Yeah.
And we all looked at each other, very young, very naive at that stage, to say, now who's going to be the CEO? And I suppose the team said, I will be the CEO. There was no process whatsoever, no interviews, nothing.
Like, we pick you.
Yeah, exactly. Sitting in the boardroom. But I think what we did, then we also created a new post of a chairman. So we made a colleague to be the chairman as well. So the idea that was that we will work together collectively, but also the idea that I'm not alone. And it's a collective. You just happen to be the the face there, and I had to learn, very fast, steep learning curve, in many ways. But if I were to pick up lessons, and I later realized that I also needed to learn technically, and hence the programs I've done, with Harvard University, which helped me immensely. In my formation as a leader. But I think if I were to pick up one or two things, lessons from leadership broadly, is that everybody in an organization has got something to offer.
Mm.
And my role as a leader is to create an opportunity for that particular individual to thrive and offer that, because that's an opportunity I was denied in my formative years in my career.
Yeah.
I vowed at that point that I will make sure that young people who come to do training under my tutelage, I'll empower them, believe in them, and make sure that their God-given talents flourish. being a leader does not mean that you know it all. You know, you need to humble yourself that there's quite a lot that you can learn from your people.
Oh, I like that. Bra Victor, thank you for coming in. This has been an incredible, insightful conversation. Thank you for making time for us.
Thank you so much, Clement. It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
All right. Yeah. It's a minute before 11 o'clock.